You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, a stand-up comedian tells us about her new memoir, which she calls A Social Justice Meets Comedy Manifesto.
First, Wisconsin's Government Accountability Board is winding down its work as the agency prepares to disband on June 29th after nearly a decade of existence. The Election and Campaign Agency was created as a bipartisan effort, and it was the only nonpartisan model of its kind in the United States. Supporters call the agency, commonly referred to as the GAB, a pioneering success. Critics call it a failed experiment. Earlier this year, Governor Walker signed a law calling for the dissolution of the GAB, which is being replaced by separate ethics and elections boards whose members will be named by the two political parties.
Kevin Kennedy is with us for an exit interview as the GAB prepares to end its work. He's led the agency since its inception. He's the director and general counsel of the Government Accountability Board. Kevin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Well, let's start with where the GAB began. Why did state lawmakers create the Government Accountability Board?
Well, the primary impetus for it was the caucus scandal of 2000-2001, where both political parties were running political campaigns out of state offices with state funds, and it was a bit of an open secret, but no one was snitching on the other person because they were doing it. But there was also an interest in one-stop shopping. In other words, people would call the elections board, which I ran for a number of years before that, ask a question, but we'd have to say, but you also need to talk to the ethics board to get advice on the lobbying or ethics implications of that. So there was a concern that people often had to make two phone calls to get an answer to a complex set of issues that might be in front of them.
As we mentioned, this was the first nonpartisan elections board in the nation. Was it difficult to pioneer that kind of agency?
Actually, it wasn't at all. First of all, the staff of the two former agencies were both nonpartisan, and the ethics board was a nonpartisan entity. And Wisconsin has a strong tradition of nonpartisanship in our judges, our school board members, even the legislatures. Drafting Bureau and Fiscal Bureau and Audit Bureau are all nonpartisan. So it's not an unusual circumstance in Wisconsin where we don't have people who register to vote by a political party. It was actually very good because we had trained decision makers, people who'd spent a career on the bench making difficult decisions. So in that sense, that also made it very easy because it wasn't someone who put their finger up to the wind to say, you know, what does the person who's nominating me think I should do?
So the GAB has overseen some of the most difficult and contentious political moments in Wisconsin's recent history, including the recall elections in 2012. What was the most difficult thing you faced as director of the Government Accountability Board?
Well, I think that was really the biggest challenge. Was it wasn't just one element. It all started in 2011. You know, right after the Packers won the Super Bowl, we ended up with the budget repair bill and 100,000 people in and out of the Capitol, legislators running to Illinois to thwart action. We had recalls against all 16 senators that were available, 9 of which went to election, a statewide recount, total change in the redistricting process. That's all just in the first half of 2011. And once the recall elections were certified, we were in court 10 times, and our decisions were upheld each of those times. But then we ended up getting ready for what was widely seen as the 2012 recall, which is the first ever statewide recall that looked like would have a chance, and it did, of forcing a recall election. So we had to recall the governor, the lieutenant governor. There's some very novel legal questions. It was just constant from, you know, February of 2011 till the middle of 2012.
As we alluded to earlier, the GAB has certainly also been the target of quite a bit of criticism over the years, one in the area of John Doe investigations that were seen to be targeting Governor Walker and his administration. The GAB was sued by Wisconsin's Club for Growth, and the club attorney had this to say about their position on the GAB's interpretation of its mandate.
They've ignored all of those and essentially become an arm of a John Doe investigation. And it's our contention that the law doesn't permit that.
So how would you, or how did you respond to that criticism, and did it change the way that the GAB did their day-to-day work?
It did not change the way the GAB did its day-to-day work. I mean, that was their characterization of it. They did get a favorable ruling from the state Supreme Court the nature of the investigation, although it was focused more on what the district attorney's role than it was on what we were doing. But the legal theory that the GAB had, was using when it opened up its investigation, which was, initiated by the GAB, was one that had been upheld by Court of Appeals in Wisconsin before that. It was the advice we had provided, and the board, I think, rightly, when it was presented with facts that suggested there was a violation of the law as it had been applied for years, did what it was supposed to do. It didn't ignore a violation. It started to gather evidence to see if it could be sustained in court. Now, we never finished the investigation because it was thwarted by a multitude of lawsuits and ultimately a court decision that reversed the theory of law that had been in place for years.
We're talking with Kevin Kennedy right now. He's director and general counsel of the Government Accountability Board, which will be disbanded at the end of the month. So as we said, the legislation that has disbanded the GAB also puts in place separate ethics and elections boards, which, as you said, was what the GAB was formed out of originally. So what will this new system look like? Is it significantly different than what the predecessors of the GAB were?
It is significantly different from what the predecessors were. As I said, the old ethics board was a nonpartisan board, serving six-year terms. Probably its biggest challenge was the fact that it had the same director for 34 years and only two chairs. So it was pretty institutionalized over its 34-year existence. The elections board was a bipartisan board, but it always tilted one way or the other because the governor had a direct appointment in addition to the nominations that came from the political parties. And then there's a Supreme Court member. So it was not unusual that it wasn't an evenly balanced board. And they only had two-year terms, so there was not a lot of historical significance. This new board is really less of an executive branch agency under the governor's appointment. It's much more, it's a legislative branch agency because the four legislative leaders directly appoint four of the six commissioners on each commission. And then they give the governor a limited list of individuals to pick. And it's evenly balanced between people who are Democrats and Republicans based on the appointment process. So it's much different in that sense. It's not a whole lot different in that the deliberations that the Ethics Commission will be engaged in will be behind closed doors, just as the deliberations of the Government Accountability Board. So you don't get any more transparency. And that was one of the faults I thought the Government Accountability Board had, was that when we had complaints on lobbying and campaign finance, we could not discuss them in public. That we cannot make the materials or the staff's recommendation available in public. And I think that fueled some of the criticism, as unsupported as it was. And I think that would have been a change that would have been laudable, but that's not going to happen with the Ethics Commission.
Why do you think lawmakers decided to end the Government Accountability Board?
Well, because one political party held control of everything, and it was very clear that the legislature wanted to control the agencies that affected their reelection, their money, their ethics advice. They were very unhappy with the fact that an independent executive branch agency with trained decision makers that was not beholden to them would be making these decisions. And that's really the root of it.
And given that these new boards are going to be staffed by people who are appointed by the legislature and okayed by the governor, what kind of confidence do you have in them providing a true oversight role with the legislature and the executive branch?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. I would just caution, it's the decision makers that are direct appointments. The nonpartisan staff pretty much remains the same. All of the staff, except for me, is transitioning into positions with the new agencies doing the work that they mm-hmm. did before. It's just that the decision makers on the commission
right.
who will be different than the judges.
Right. I misspoke on that. So it's actually people that are holding the chairs on these.
Right. But, you know, I think we'll have to wait and see. But it's pretty clear that there's a very real possibility that people would split along partisan lines on contentious issues. I mean, a lot of what comes in front of the commissions is not going to be that controversial. Maybe we'll wait and see how the Elections Commission decides to implement the new voter ID education program to get a sense of that. The Ethics Commission is going to be a little bit behind because they still have to hire an administrator to run the commission.
Well, Kevin, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
That was Kevin Kennedy, Director and General Counsel of the Government Accountability Board, which will be disbanded as of the end of the month.
Coming of age and trying to find your place in the world can be a complicated experience for people who grow up with a hyphen or two in their identities, like Iranian American Muslim female, for example. That experience can be especially unique.
Well, our next guest talks about just that in her work. Nagin Farsad is a comedian, actor, writer, and filmmaker based in New York City. In her new memoir, How to Make White People Laugh, she talks about growing up Iranian American in the post 9/11 world and using comedy to fight racism. Nagin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we're glad to have you. And you describe your book as a social justice meets comedy manifesto. What does that mean exactly?
Well, I sort of do the kind of work that I do, I generally refer to as social justice comedy because it's not partisan, you know what I mean? It's about justice. It's inviting and warm. It makes you feel like you're sitting inside of a burrito. And it's funny, but it might, you know, have some kind of sneaky information embedded in it. You know, you could be hearing a sophisticated treatise on, you know, criminal justice reform, but like inside of a poop joke. And so that's kind of the main hallmarks of that kind of work.
Well, you did a TED Talk about the work of the social justice comedian. Here's a clip from that talk.
Now, the American population can be broken up into three main categories. There's mostly wonderful people, haters, and Florida. Now, besides Florida, the most troubling category here are the haters, okay? They are a minority, but they overcompensate by being extra loud. They have the Napoleon complex of demographics, and yes, some of the men do wear heels. Now, as a social justice comedian, it's my goal to convert these haters because they hate a lot of things which lead to negative outcomes like racism, violence, and Ted Nugent.
So converting the haters, can you really do that with comedy? How does that work?
I'm not delusional. I know that like one joke isn't going to save the world or anything like that, but I kind of view these things as like being on a continuum where, you know, there, you know, someone might be exposed to a joke here, a movie there, a TV show somewhere else. And over time, if you add that the message is going to, kind of stay with them until finally, you know, hopefully one day it changes them, or like may helps them see something differently. Because I think the thing with laughter is that, you know, it makes people feel, you know, laughter is very vulnerable. And in that vulnerability, I think you're able to kind of hear a message in a way that you wouldn't if it was presented to you in a serious format or maybe in a brochure or some kind of lectury way. And so that's kind of one of the things that I think it is so effective about comedy.
And you write that for a good chunk of your life, you identified with Black or Mexican people. You were one of only two Iranian Americans in your school, and the other one had an iguana for a pet, and that's a no-go for you in making friends with someone. So what was it like to not have, you refer to it as when you're one or two of a very small racial minority, you don't have a posse. So how did you find yourself being drawn to Black and Mexican cultures?
You know, I think what happens with a lot of people who are in the kind of severely underpopulated ethnic minorities is that they sort of glom onto the other larger, more dominant minority groups, you know. So growing up for me in Southern California, that was Mexican Americans, and they had, you know, everything in our town. They had, radio stations and restaurants and issues and icons like Cesar Chavez, and really, you know, and I wanted, and it was so seductive to me, and I I knew that they weren't, you know, that I wasn't Mexican. You know what I mean? I was never trying to pass. But I sort of longed to be among them because I was like, eh, they're not Iranian, but they're close enough, you know? And so I think that's kind of what a lot of hyphenated Americans do at certain stages of their life because they just are looking for a thing where they belong.
And we've got another clip of you from a TED Talk again where you were the only non-black person in your African-American studies graduate program.
And that's when I had to reckon with my own identity, right? To really recognize that I'm, it turns out, not Mexican or black, that I'm actually an Iranian-American Muslim female. The only problem with that was that the icons that were available to me were kind of lame.
So tell us about that last part. What were the icons that you were seeing and what made them hard to connect with or lame, as you put it?
In the aftermath of 9/11, when I was going to graduate school for African American studies, later all of my master's degree turned out to be unnecessary, as I am a comedian, but don't regret doing it. But what the kind of icons that were available to me at that time were like, you know, dusty bearded dudes in the desert wielding weapons who seem really sinister, and they're always like running in formation. And then the other kind of major icon of the Middle East was women who were covered in the burqa. Sometimes their eyes weren't even visible, and they were just, and it looks as though they are floating. They don't even have legs, you know. And of course, like if you're Iranian, there's like that one fun icon, which is, the delicious uranium cake, because Iranians are always enriching uranium, which I'm doing that, you know, on the other side of the phone call right now, just enriching uranium casually. But these are the things that were available to me, I think, as icons, and I just was like, I don't see myself in any of these things. You know, I'm into, cute dresses and honey mustard and African-American studies, you know, so where's that icon? And so I think one of the things that I had to reckon with was that we sort of have to build a new identity, you know, in the United States because it's been so warped by various geopolitical occurrences that have nothing to do with, you know, Muslims in America.
Well, it seems like that's what you're doing in a way. You are building new icons, and you yourself are becoming one of those icons as a director and a writer and a comedian. You directed The Muslims Are Coming, which was this hit documentary. Have you seen a difference in the kinds of role models you're creating and the way that people are thinking about you and the work that you do?
I mean, I'm not sure, you know, like, I can't say that I've seen it necessarily a difference, but I do feel like the work is touching more people. And I get messages, you know, from like 16-year-old Filipino-American girls in Iowa. You know, I remember getting an email literally from a 16-year-old Filipino-American in Iowa, like after The Muslims Are Coming came out, who said, oh, this, you know, I really identified with your film, and I didn't realize that it would kind of speak to someone who's so different from me, but we're actually still so the same. And I remember also getting a message from someone who had served in the military in Afghanistan because he hated Muslims, because he wanted to take them down. And after serving for so long and meeting Muslims, he started to kind of soften in that position. And then over time, you know, he came back to the United States and realized that he really didn't hate Muslims. and then he saw my movie that was a message that was like, oh yeah, this is exactly what I mean. They're fun, they can be hilarious and bad at bowling. And that feels like more Muslim to me than anything else. And so I have gotten messages like this from people that I find really encouraging about the work.
We're talking with Nagin Farsad, a comedian, filmmaker, writer, and actor. We're talking about her new memoir, How to Make White People Laugh. Well, the book certainly has a sense of humor, as you do, obviously, but you also don't shy away from politics and some of the darker sides of your experience. Tell us how you understood the Iranian hostage crisis as a kid living in Virginia.
Well, I mean, my parents had moved just in time for the Iran hostage crisis. And so they kind of, and they, you know, we were living in Virginia, in a quite kind of hardcore. This wasn't like a suburb of D.C. or anything. This was like a real part of Virginia in which they were like a really, 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 really small minority. And they were not treated very well. You know, I grew up in Southern California, because I was a baby when we left there. And so I had it easier because it was a lot more culturally diverse in Southern California than it was in Virginia. But I remember being in kindergarten and a kid says to me, like, oh, you guys are communists. And in Iran, I mean, everybody hated Iran in the early 80s. And this is something we probably don't remember. And I really didn't experience it to the extent that my parents did and my brother. But people really hated Iran. It was like a big thing. And during the Iran hostage crisis, of course, you know, with Iran's actions. But they just, like, discriminated against Iranians in the United States. And my parents suffered the brunt of that. And that kid came to me at school one day and said, like, you're a communist. And I was like, that you mean Islamic Republic. And then that was the extent of a couple of four-year-olds could talk about. But I just remember very, you know, distinctly that, like, being Iranian was not considered a great thing.
And just briefly as we wrap up, we've got a little bit less than a minute, but we've been talking about everything we've been discussing today at a time when the presumptive Republican nominee is calling for a temporary ban on Muslim immigration. Is the landscape of the current election affecting how you see your work and how it affects people?
I mean, it just feels, it's funny because every time I think, like, you know, we're warming up to Muslims, it's going to be fine. Like, Trump says another thing, and then it's not fine again. You know what I mean? So I'm really hopeful, and I think there's been such a groundswell of support for Muslims, you know, and against this kind of rhetoric, and hopefully that'll continue because it's, he said a lot of stuff about Muslims, about Mexicans, and those statements are, you know, they're just bigoted. So that's how it looks. That's what it looks like from here.
Nagin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Nagin Farsad. She is a comedian, actor, writer, and filmmaker based in New York City. And she talked to us about her new memoir. It's called How to Make White People Laugh.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up at 7 o'clock tonight, it's the Moth Radio Hour. Tonight, a college student goes running with the bulls in Pamplona, Spain. Bicycle shopping gets complicated. And a man sees warning signs on a Match.com date. That's coming up at 7 tonight on the Moth.
First, the U.S. Supreme Court issued opinions today on two controversial topics.
In the case of Fisher versus the University of Texas at Austin, high school student Abigail Fisher challenged the university's affirmative action policy, which she says gave priority to minority students over her.
And the case of the United States versus Texas considered whether a portion of President Obama's immigration reform package was constitutional.
Both of these cases had two very different opinions coming down from the court and could have some long-term political and legal ramifications.
Joining us now to discuss both cases is Barbara Perry. She's a professor of political science and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Barbara, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Judith.
Well, a lot to talk about. Let's start with the Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin case, where the Supreme Court originally decided to listen to the case. This is what plaintiff Abigail Fisher told reporters.
Like most Americans, I don't believe that students should be treated differently based on their race. Hopefully, this case will end racial classifications and preferences in admissions at the University of Texas.
So, Barbara, what were the stakes at play in this case, both for Fisher and for the University of Texas at Austin?
Well, of course, Ms. Fisher has long ago finished her undergraduate training, but she was, in her mind, denied admission to the University of Texas, she thought, because others with lesser qualifications because of their race or ethnicity were put ahead of her. So for her, it will be a moot point, but obviously for the nation, that is for those states that have not outlawed the use of race in hiring or admissions, and there are several who have, California, Florida, for example, Michigan, I believe. That means that across the country, then, the higher education can continue both in undergraduate and professional schools to consider race as a qualification or as a factor for admission.
Well, President Obama commended the Supreme Court's ruling on this case.
He did.
In the affirmative action case, I'm pleased that the Supreme Court upheld the basic notion that diversity is an important value in our society and that this country should provide a high-quality education to all our young people, regardless of their background. We are not a country that guarantees equal outcomes, but we do strive to provide an equal shot to everybody, and that's what was upheld today.
So that's an interesting point that President Obama made at the end. He said, we're not a country that guarantees equal outcomes, but he said, we do try to provide an equal shot to everyone. Why does this case speak that to him and maybe to the rest of the country?
Right. Well, this has been a long-standing conflict going back certainly to the 1970s and even to the 1960s, right after the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which was an attempt to allow equal opportunity, that is, equal access for all, both in education and in employment. Not long after that passage of that bill in 1964 with the presidential leadership of Lyndon Johnson, he gave a speech at Howard University in Washington, a historically black university, in which he said that it's still not enough to bring people up to the starting line, using the race metaphor, that is a running race metaphor, to bring everybody up to the starting line, fire off the gun, and expect that people who have been given opportunities over the years, perhaps because of their race, or have had access to opportunities over the years, and expect that everyone would come out at the end at an equal result. So that concept of equal opportunity versus equal result has been an ongoing controversy going back at least that far. What the president was trying to say is this still is a focus on the opportunity rather than the result. In other words, give everybody the opportunity to come into colleges or professional schools. We can't guarantee how everyone will do once they're in there.
So let's go into the mechanics of this case. And what did the Supreme Court find compelling that led to the decision that it made in favor of the University of Texas at Austin?
Right. Well, as the president said in his statement, that this country, as he pointed out, puts a premium on diversity, and certainly his own personal story is one of diversity, and his presidency is one of diversity. And he was making that statement, I think, as a historical case. But actually, the U.S. Supreme Court has made a legal case for diversity, and this goes back all the way to late 1978, the famous Bakke case that came out of California, in which a very narrowly divided court decided that it would be a good thing for, in that case, medical schools to have racial and ethnic diversity. That legally then is what the court calls a compelling state interest, and it has decided legally under its reading of the Constitution that diversity is a compelling state interest, and therefore race and ethnicity can be taken into some consideration, though that consideration has to be what they call narrowly tailored to meet that compelling state interest. And that's under a test that they call strict scrutiny. So whenever the government uses race or ethnicity in any way, in any classification, it triggers automatically what is called strict judicial scrutiny. And then those criteria of a compelling state interest and a narrow tailoring have to apply. So over all of those years, since the late 1970s, when the first affirmative action case in education came to the court, it has struggled with this, but it has usually ended on the side where it ended up today, again narrowly, but that is approving of diversity as a compelling state interest and therefore giving government, in this case the University of Texas, a public university, the right and the okay to continue using race and ethnicity as a means to achieve diversity in its student body.
We're taking a look at two different decisions that were handed down today by the U.S. Supreme Court, and Barbara Perry is joining us to discuss those. She's professor of political science and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Well, we do have a 4-4 split often on the current court because Justice Antonin Scalia's seat is still open. What was the breakdown of votes from the justices in this case?
In this case, interestingly enough, it was 4-3, and listeners might be saying, well, now we've lost another justice. And so instead of the 8, where we sometimes end up with a 4-4 ruling, Justice Kagan had recused herself. She had stepped aside from this decision because she had come from the Justice Department of the Obama administration as Solicitor General. So she viewed herself as having an interest in this case. She stepped aside. So it came down 4-3, with only 7 justices participating. And interestingly enough, Justice Kennedy, who sometimes is a swing voter, sometimes he's on the conservative side, sometimes he's on the liberal side, he joined the liberals today, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor, to create this 4-person majority over the 3 conservatives, Roberts, Alito, and Justice Thomas.
And who wrote the dissenting opinion, and what did they say in it?
Justice Alito wrote a very lengthy lead dissent, 51 pages, I understand, and read a good portion, if not all of it, from the bench. And whenever justices do that in the dissent, it usually is a sign that they are particularly agitated, because oftentimes a dissenting justice will say, I dissent, and here's the summary of my reasons for doing so. But in cases like this that are so emotional and hot button and political and narrowly decided on the legal grounds, and we see these particularly at the end of a term when they save the cases they've struggled with the most over that term, and this is coming to the end of their term for 2015-16, the fact that Justice Alito read out his decision in dissent, I should say, indicates that he was pretty agitated about it. And the position is one that's pretty easy to understand from that position, that side, and it is that the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause focuses on the term equal, and that is that there should not be any kind of extra incentive given to or extra plus given to a person because of his or her race or ethnicity.
You were just saying how controversial and hot button and emotional affirmative action arguments and cases are, and there are frequent challenges to affirmative action. What does that say about race relations in this country, that this is not an issue that's anywhere near settled, really?
It's not, and it probably never will be, in the sense that because of our history of slavery, because of the unique position that race played in our founding and led to a civil war, for heaven's sake, it means that it will probably always be an issue. Those on the opposite side of it, those who are against it, the Robertses, the Alitos, and the Thomases on this current court, make a case that's pretty persuasive, and that is, well, of course it won't ever go away if institutions and employers are still allowed to use ethnicity and race as a plus in employment or in admissions to universities.
Moving on to the United States versus Texas, which was a challenge to President Obama's deferred deportation for the undocumented parents of legal U.S. citizens, what about that program was being challenged?
Right. Well, specifically, the fact that the president had taken this action as an executive order because he could not get Congress, and in fact, we know Congress for many, many years now has been unable to come to creating an act or creating a piece of legislation to be passed by both houses of Congress that would pave a way to citizenship, or if you view it more neutrally, comprehensive reform measures on immigration. There just is not been that majority available in the House and Senate to create a piece of legislation, pass it, and get it to the president's desk. So the president, in frustration, created this executive order in 2014, November, in fact, of 2014, to try to expand another order that he had created in 2012 to try to decrease the number of deportations and give those, in the case of the 2012 order, give children who came to this country younger than at age 16 and before 2007 an exemption from deportation, give them a renewable 2-year work permit, so allow them to work, pay taxes, have some of the benefits, but not have a path to citizenship. That remains in place, so that status quo remains. But this other order that came following that, which was to help the parents of those children, to give them some of the same benefits, some protection from deportation, or at least to put them at the low end of likelihood of deportation, that was what was stopped or enjoined by the courts in Texas shortly after 26 states brought a challenge to that executive order, this most recent one, and that remains blocked. The case today, the court did not make a decision on it per se because it was stymied 4-4, but it means that the Texas court's decision remains in place. So that order will not be able to be put into place by the president and his administration.
We're talking right now with Barbara Perry. She's a professor of political science and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. And we're discussing the Supreme Court's opinions on affirmative action and challenges to President Obama's immigration reform package just released today.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. Do you agree with the Supreme Court's opinions on these topics? And what role do you think affirmative action should play, if any? And do you think President Obama overstepped his office with his immigration reform plan? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave your comments over on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also email your opinion to talk@WPR.org. We're continuing our conversation about two Supreme Court decisions issued today, one which upheld affirmative action, and the second was a split decision about whether or not President Obama's immigration reform package was constitutional. And we want to hear your opinion about these decisions. Is there still a role for affirmative action in our society today? What do you think that should be? Or if not, tell us that as well. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're picking up our conversation now with Barbara Perry. She's a professor of political science and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Now, in a news conference today, House Speaker Paul Ryan said that the opinion on President Obama's immigration package was a victory for Congress.
This is a win for the Constitution. It's a win for Congress. And it's a win in our fight to restore the separation of powers. Presidents don't write laws. Congress writes laws. This is a case that the House weighed in on because it's fundamental to our system of checks and balances. Congress, not the president, writes our laws. And today, the Supreme Court validated that very core, essential, fundamental principle.
So, Barbara, do you see this challenge more about the actual immigration program itself, or because Congress thought that President Obama overreached with his executive power?
I think it was both. I think you have a group in Congress, some Republicans, to be sure, who are not in favor of moving towards path to citizenship. Rather, they might be more in favor of deporting illegals who are here. And so on the substance of the president's executive order, they would not want that order to go forward or that policy to go forward, which is why they have not created a policy coming out of the legislative process of the Congress. So part of it is the policy and its content. But there definitely is, as Speaker Ryan said, there definitely is a constitutional issue involved here about who makes the laws in our federal system. And most people who've had basic civics know that it's the Congress's power to write laws, it's the court's power to interpret them, and it's the president's power, as the separation of power system operates, to execute the powers, to take them into practice, but not to create the actual policy.
So as we mentioned earlier, the court is currently making rulings with only 8 members instead of 9 because there is the empty seat as a result of Justice Antonin Scalia's death. This case split 4-4. Why did the case split the way it did, and who ended up on each side?
Right. Well, again, you have the typical conservative liberal split. In this case, there was no one who recused himself or herself, as in the affirmative action case. So on one side, you have conservatives, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, and that swing voter who in this instance apparently moved over to the conservative side, Justice Kennedy, and more than likely Justice Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan on the liberal side. But oftentimes when these cases are divided and there's no opinion that actually comes down, the court just announces in effect that it is divided, and what happens in our judicial process is then that whatever lower court decision was being challenged, in this case the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in Texas, based in Texas, that decision will stand, and that was the one that said that it should block the president's policy. So this is an example of what happens when you do not have a full complement of nine justices.
Well, not surprisingly, President Obama also had a comment about this case.
Now, as disappointing as it was to be challenged for taking the kind of action that other administrations have taken, the country was looking to the Supreme Court to resolve the important legal questions raised in this case. Today, the Supreme Court was unable to reach a decision. This is part of the consequence of the Republican failure so far to give a fair hearing to Mr. Merrick Garland, my nominee to the Supreme Court. It means that the expanded set of common sense deferred action policies, the ones that I announced 2 years ago, can't go forward at this stage until there is a ninth justice on the court to break the tie.
So that's an interesting comment from the president. He, in passing, mentions the ruling or the lack of decision by the split court, but then he turns it around to the fact that there has been no movement on his nominee for the Supreme Court. He's laying the blame squarely at the feet of Republicans. Barbara Perry, is he justified in that?
In that the leadership of the Senate has made the determination that it would not go forward with any kind of hearing on Judge Garland. By all accounts, from both sides of the aisle, an exceptionally qualified federal judge from the D.C. Circuit. So the president is actually right on point to say this is what happens when you have a blockage in the Senate, and this is unprecedented. There's never been in the modern era, since there have been Senate hearings, there's never been a hearing blocked for a president's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in fact, just the opposite has happened, that even when you have a significant portion of the Senate who's against and opposing the president's nominee, and maybe the president, maybe the court itself, maybe the court majority, most of the time in our history, again in the modern era particularly, with hearings that have been televised at least, you have that opposition using the hearings to make their case. And in this instance, the Senate decided, through the Republican leadership, not to hold any hearings, and many Republicans not even to reach out as a courtesy to Judge Garland. By the way, that strategy did work in this instance, in this case. With the 4-4 tie works to the advantage of the Republicans and the conservatives who did not want the president's immigration policy to go through and be carried out. It didn't work, we should point out, in the affirmative action case. So it's rather a gamble on the part of the Republicans, not only for these cases, but it's also a gamble that they hope their candidate will win in November and that they'll have Donald Trump's nominee to the Supreme Court.
Let's go briefly to the phones in the minute or so we have left, and Gil in Madison is up. Hi, Gil.
Hi. So I had a question about both of the cases. You may not have time to address it, but in the Texas case on affirmative action, am I right? No, on immigration. Why is it that the Texas ruling now stands nationally if it's because there's a tie vote, if it's only an appeals court in that part of the country?
It's a good question, Gil, because usually, as you expressed it, it is the case. That is, that when there's a 4-4 tie, it's usually the circuit and only the states in that circuit, and there are usually four or five states that constitute a federal appeals court circuit, that it will only apply. But in this instance, you had 26 states who had challenged the policy on the part of the president, and the fact was that the movement forward was just simply stopped. In other words, there was an enjoinment or an enjoining or a staying of the president's order.
And Barbara, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us. Barbara Perry is a professor of political science and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center.